right out of the box this afternoon, a guest who has won Emmy Awards. He's won the Thurber Prize for American Humor, was one of the original writers for Saturday Night Live. It's Gary Shandling's show, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Author of books like The Other Shulman, a children's book, Our Tree Named Steve, Clothing Optional, Lunatics with Dave Barry, and on, including an intimate connection to this song.
My story is seldom told. I squandered my resistance for a pocket full of mumbles, such are promises.
We are thrilled to be joined this afternoon by legendary writer Alan Zweibel. Alan, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well,
it just made me laugh with the when I heard the box.
Well, we've teed that up out of the box. Can you tell that story, please? Because I just love it.
Well, you know, it harkens back to when I was in college. This is in the early 70s. I took a poetry writing class, and I was failing. I was failing. And had I failed it, I would have failed out of college, and the Vietnam War was raging, and God knows where I would have ended up, if I would have ended up in the war. So as a last-ditch effort, we had a 92-year-old teacher. And as a last-ditch effort to avoid getting an F on a Friday where we handed in our poetry journals, I handed in the lyrics to Paul Simon's song, The Boxer, thinking that a 92-year-old woman, you know, wouldn't recognize it. And come Monday, I was right. She didn't recognize it. But the bad news was she was so impressed by it that she wanted me to come up and read it. My poem to the rest of the class. And I'm begging off and I'm saying, no, you know, I really don't like speaking in front of people. I'm thrilled you like my poem. And she just, you know, she prevailed on me. And I went up in front of the class and I started reading it. And when I got to the point where when I left my home and my family, I was no more than a boy in the company of strangers. In the quiet of the railway station, running scared, laying low, seeking out poorer quarters where the ragged people go, looking for the places only they would know. The whole class started singing, "Lie, la, lie, lie, la, lie, lie, lie." It was, oh God! But you know, but the 92-year-old teacher, you know, she just looked at the class and says, "Yeah, it's inspiring, isn't it?" So I got away with it. I got an A. And I became friends with Paul Simon years later. And when he saw me, that was actually from a book that I had written called The Other Shulman. You mentioned it in your intro. And I read from it on the Letterman show. And the whole audience started singing Lila Lie. Paul Simon emailed me the next day mentioning something about how sales of the boxer has shot up. I read from the, you know, on the Letterman show. So it's really been... That's really been a fun ride. That one thing that I wrote, it was in, like I said, it was in a novel, and I read from it on a show, and it's been, you know, I do my speaking engagements, I tell that story, and it's, boy, I've got a lot of miles out of that.
You've also got a great story of how you became a comedy writer.
Well, you mean at the very, very beginning?
Yes.
Well, that was really not my choice. That was a decision made for me by every law school in the United States. When I was in college, you know, once again, this is late 60s, early 70s, and there was a war, and kids wanted to extend their education by going to law school, medical school, professional school. And I thought I wanted to be a lawyer, but every law school in the United States saw my law board scores, they probably got together and said, no, this is silly, you know. So, I ended up writing jokes, you know, which is really what I wanted to do. But especially back then, now you've got all these film schools and you've got UCB and you've got all these places where kids can go to start training, you know, for a career in comedy, you know, and paying their dues that way. Back then, there really wasn't. There was no prescribed course of action. So you know, I figured, okay, maybe I'll become a lawyer so I have something to fall back on. I had no idea what to do. So I ended up writing jokes for comedians in the Catskill Mountains. There used to be all these hotels up in the Catskill Mountain region in New York that had these huge nightclubs in it. And that's where show business, that was the breeding ground back in the 50s and the 60s. Alan King and Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis and all of them started there. But by the time I got there in the early 70s, I was left with the guys who were never going to make it. All the guys who were really good went on to have TV shows and movie careers. And I was left with all these other guys who were really nice men and very competent comedians, but really weren't distinct in their personalities. You know, if a joke did work for one guy, I gave it to another. You know, there was nothing specific about their persona, you know. Years later, when I wrote for people like, let's say, Rodney Dangerfield, you know, it was easier because Rodney used to say, I don't get no respect. So it was easy to have him say, you know, even as an infant, my mother wouldn't breastfeed me. She said she liked me as a friend. You know, that was easier. So.
So 1975, you're a young guy, early 20s, and at a crossroads of sorts, a brand new show that's getting started by Lorne Michaels. But the other opportunity you had was to write for Hollywood Squares, right, for Paul Lynde?
Well, it was really, and at the time, it sounds absurd now that we're talking about it, you know, some 44 years later, but at the time, you know, Hollywood Squares was going into its ninth season. It was a network show. It was in California where the whole industry was, you know, so it was higher pay scales, really great exposure. And each one of the squares had a star in it, all of whom had their own variety shows or Las Vegas acts. So it would have been, so I thought, or so the thinking was, I should say, well, okay, do that, you know, and become chummy with one or two of the people who have their own TV shows, and I'll ask you to come write for it. Where on the other hand, there was this Saturday Night Live thing. It was going to be on at 11:30 to 1 on Saturday nights, which was an ungodly hour, okay? East Coast, late night, which meant it was a much lower pay scale. Who the hell is John Belushi? Who's Gilda Radner, you know? So it was, for maybe 12 seconds, I said, gee, which one should I choose? No, 12 seconds is an exaggeration. I'd say for a half a second. But, you know, as luck would have it, you know, I was struggling. I was living home with my parents. I was writing jokes. I was working at a delicatessen in Queens, New York, you know, to supplement this great living I was making as a writer. And, you know, I go, all right, well, what should I do? And I said, gee, if I'm going to fail, I want to at least fail doing something I enjoyed. It seemed like the sensibility that I, you know, it was my peer group age-wise. So, yeah, that's what I did.
We're talking
Thank God.
Alan Zweibel here on Downtown. On your first day on the job, a meeting that in many ways changed your life when you met Gilda Radner.
Well, yeah, I was, I went upstairs to Lauren's office and before the meeting started, I looked around and I saw Belushi and Aykroyd and Franken and Lorraine Newman. And they were all trained, you know, Second City or the Groundlings. You know, it was improv people, you know. Mm. And it was a kind of humor that I had not been exposed to. I may not have even have heard seriously at that point of Second City. So I saw them playing around in Lorne's office and just creating stuff right in front of me on their feet. And they were hilarious. And I was this, you know, big Jewish joke writer from Long Island. So I got a little intimidated. I went behind behind a potted plant that Lorne had in his office. And the meeting started. And at one point, early into the meeting, I heard a girl's voice say, can you help me be a parakeet? And I parted the leaves and I saw Gilda. And I said, what? And she said, yeah, I think it would be really funny if I stood on a perch and scrunched up my face like a parakeet, but I need a writer to help me figure out what the parakeet should say. are you a good parakeet writer? I have no idea what any of that meant, okay? But at least somebody was talking to me, and I went, yeah, I'm a great parakeet writer. And she said, look, is there any room behind the plant? I looked, and I said, yeah, why? She said, well, I'm a little nervous. It's my first TV show, too. And so I scooched over, and she came, and that's where I met my buddy, Gilda, squatting behind the plant.
You created with her Emily Latella, Rosanna Dana. What was the dynamic? Did you write for specific performers? Did they ask to work with you? How did that whole thing develop?
You can write for and with anybody that you want. So during the 5 years I was there, I wrote with Franken. I wrote with Dan Aykroyd. I wrote for Dan Aykroyd. I wrote for Weekend Update, which is something that I had a big hand in all 5 years. That meant I wrote for Chevy and Jane Curtin and Bill Murray. And the combinations of writers and actors was just, you know, the permutations were huge, you know. So if you had an idea that you thought you had a personal vision about, well, then you wrote it. But if I called Gild into my office and say, listen, I think it would be a great idea if you played Howdy Doody's wife, Debbie Doody, and she just started jumping around in my office like she was hanging from strings, you know, and we'd write together, you know. And I wrote The Samurais for John Belushi, which was another writer named Tom Schiller had created. He wrote Samurai Hotel. That was the first one. But then Lorne came up to me subsequent to that, and Lorne knew that I worked in a delicatessen before I got the job at SNL. He said, you work in a deli, right? I said, yeah. He said, can you write Samurai Deli? And once again, I said, oh, you bet. And when he walked away, I had no idea what the hell I was doing. But, you know, so like you can write with anyone, for anyone. And it was a lot of fun that way. You got to flex different muscles depending upon the sensibilities of the people around you.
The show was so different, and nobody knew what to expect. I think it replaced Carson reruns on
That's
Saturday night.
Right.
And there had
yeah.
been the other, was it Saturday Night with Howard Cosell on ABC that preceded the show? So, and even the first couple of episodes, I remember being there watching 1975. George Carlin did multiple monologues on that first show. There wasn't a lot of time early on to get sketches onto the air.
Well, when you think about the very, very first show, you had George Carlin, who did a lot of monologues, right? Then you also had Andy Kaufman,
right,
who did a stand-up back. I think he might have done Mighty Mouse, I'm not sure. And then Valerie Bromfield got up, and she did a monologue. Billy Crystal, my buddy Billy, was supposed to be on that show, but because they were so overcrowded, they wanted to cut him down from like 7 minutes to 2.5 or something. You know, I got the numbers a little bit wrong, but it was a dramatic editing job they wanted him to do. So he didn't do the first show. But on that first show, in addition to those stand-up comedians, you also had Janice Ian, was a singer, and Billy Preston was a singer. So you had all these individual acts. So like the first Weekend Update may have been 3.5 minutes long.
Wow.
The show didn't find its form yet. You know, it took a couple. It took, you know, Lily Tomlin came and did the sixth show. You know, Rob Reiner did the third show. It started taking a little bit of form, and the sketches started getting a little bit longer, and we realized that, Lorne realized that he didn't need all these individual acts. So, it ultimately got pared down, and it became the form that it is now, and it has been for 45 years, you know?
The friendship that you had with Gilda would last for the rest of her life. You wrote the wonderful Bunny Bunny about the sort of love story. It was a one-sided love affair, and yet a very deep friendship, right?
Yeah, it was, look, I wanted it to be a boy-girl thing, and as far as she was concerned, it was just a coincidence that she was a girl and I was a boy. that didn't play any part into the relationship. But yeah, you know, we wrote a lot of things together for the 5 years I was there. In addition to those characters you mentioned, you know, we'd just call each other in the middle of the night and would say, what if, or go to mostly over dinner. But that was the same. And then when the show ended for us, we left in 1980, you know, she eventually moved to California, and I opted to stay in New York. So our friendship, you know, there was no emails. And then, you know, she was doing movies, and the three-hour time difference became a factor. So it diminished a little bit in terms of the frequency. But when I went out to California to do a pilot for a series called It's Gary Shandling Show, that put me out in California, where she lived now. And we resuscitated or jump-started our platonic friendship when, you know, I did It's Gary Shandling Show, and I brought my family out when the show became very successful. And, you know, that show was the last show that Gilda made a television appearance on. So it did last, well, let's see, from 75, and she passed away in 89. It was 14 years.
The documentary that came out last fall, Love Gilda, was so wonderful. And I understand that some of the footage in that was essentially your home movies, Gilda and Gene Wilder singing Happy Birthday to your son.
It was amazing. Yeah, my wife and I were listed as executive producers on it. And part of our duties, if you will, was to furnish them with memorabilia, you know, photos and, footage. And it was, what was really great was, it opened the Tribeca Film Festival here in New York. So we have three children who are now in their 30s, and they came. So the five of us, actually the seven of us, two of them are married, so their spouses were there. But the five of us were watching the Love Gilda, and you'd hear our kids go, "Oh, I remember that Seder. Oh, yeah, that's when Gilda sang to us at the thing." Yeah, so it was a lot of home movies that we saw there. So what I liked about them using it, whether it would be mine or any of the other ones that were in that documentary, was you got Gilda, her personal life. You got her at home. You got her, you know, who she, you know, was when she wasn't wearing a funny wig or doing a crazy dialogue, you know. And it really personalized her very, very nicely.
Is Bunny Bunny coming back to the stage sometime soon?
Well, you know, there's a couple of producers who want to do it, so I'm rewriting it and tweaking it with every hope that maybe it will. You know, I wrote it as a book in 1993 or 4 to do just for closure. My wife, Robin, said to me, you know, you should write something about you and Gilda, and I resisted, and she said, look, your best friend died. You haven't cried yet. So what I did was, for the book, I just recreated our relationship. You know, where did we meet? Oh, yeah, behind that potted plant. And I wrote down, I recreated every scene I could remember over the 14 years, ending with a eulogy that I gave at her memorial. And then I thought, okay, closure's over. Okay, and then I made it into a play, so I opened the same wound again, and now it's here is again. And Love, but you want to know something? It's a double-edged sword. As a writer, you go, gee, how many times can I do the same thing? But as a human being, you know, to go back and visit somebody that you really cared about and meant so much to you and your family, it's sort of nice, you know. So we're going to try. And, you know, let's see what happens.
You mentioned It's Gary Shandling's show. It's so far ahead of its time, such a unique show. Is it safe to say that Gary Shandling was a complex guy to work with?
Oh, God, was he ever. He was a complex guy to work with. He was a good friend. But, he was... And I mean this in a nice way. He was a genius, but I think he was a little tortured by it. You know what I mean? So he did have his demons, and yeah, you had to do a certain. You know, Judd Apatow did that wonderful 2-part series.
Oh, that was great.
The special, yeah. Well, it's the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. So as you saw me and everybody else saying it, that there was a complexity there where, you know, his work was his life. And for those people who had wives, children, and other things, there was a competition that he felt. And That being said, you know, when he passed away, I guess it's over 3 years ago now, I was just saying to my wife the other day, I miss Gary. There was a profound influence and impact that he made on all of us. You know, it's funny, a couple of months ago, once again at the Tribeca Film Festival here in New York, I saw Sarah Silverman in conversation with a great stand-up comedian named Mike Birbiglia.
Oh, love Mike. He's been on our show.
Oh, he's the best. He's really great. His one-man shows are terrific, and he's in Billions. He's really a monster talent. And I'm sitting there, and I'm watching the two of them, and some of the things that Sarah was saying, when I wrote her the next day to tell her how much I enjoyed her, I said, you know, I cited a thing or two where she alluded to sort of philosophies that Gary had. You know, it's about the work. It's not about, you know, and the Zen part of writing from the core and whatever. And I mentioned that to her, and when she wrote back, she said, he's part of my every molecule, and he still inspires me. And I know a lot of us feel that way about certain people. You know, in every aspect of all of our lives, you have people who made impact. And Gary still lingers. I know that when I write, you know, I go, all right, what would Gary do? What would Gary say? What would Gary think? You know, it's not really conscious, but every so often I'm aware, oh, yeah, I know I'm doing it.
I was so moved. I watched that documentary, all 4 hours of it, several times. I was so taken with his spirituality that I didn't know much about, and the fact that he worked so hard in his last several years to try and help the young people along the way, and without credit, reaching out and punching up scripts and looking at material, I found that so powerful.
Well, you know, he had a now legendary basketball game every Sunday.
Right.
He had a court, and I played in that game when we lived in L.A., and let's say the game was called noon, okay? I'd get there at 5 to 12, but there were guys, younger writers who were there, had been there since 10. And let's say we leave at 2. But the younger writers were still there. They didn't stay. They stayed for dinner. And what Gary did was he had these, I wouldn't say disciples, but they had devotees. He was a mentor to so many people. There's a lot of people that will tell you that Gary taught them how to write. Gary gave them their start. Gary paid for something because they didn't have insurance. And quite frankly, I didn't know some of those things until I saw Judd's documentary. You know, and then I would speak to Kevin Nealon or Bob Saget, people who were closer to Gary than myself, and they went, oh, yeah. You know, so, you know, he was a very spiritual guy. When I first met him, he was into crystals and things like that before anybody was. He had a cabin up in Big Bear where he used to go and come back with tons of ideas for the show. It was like a retreat where you go on hikes. And when he passed, all of us felt that, if there is a life after this, he was certainly ready for it because he was in touch with something else that was otherworldly.
Mm-hmm. I want to just for a moment talk about Curb Your Enthusiasm. We had the great character actor Paul Dooley on a few weeks ago who played Larry David's father-in-law, and he was talking about what he would get for material going into a scene, and essentially it was just a setup. What was the writing like on that with so much of it being improvised? Did the improvisation lead to what you put in scripts?
Well, you know, look, I was called a consulting producer for a couple of years. And in fact, what that was is I shared offices with Larry. He would come in, lie on my couch, say, what if, or this is what I'm thinking. I'd throw my 2 cents in. And then he would leave, and then he would either write an outline or embellish the outline he already had. I was in one of the episodes, and it was similar to what I just told you. What it was is they told me for the first scene, I was in three scenes, okay? And this is when Larry was shooting. This is a few years ago now. He was shooting in New York, and I live in New York. So he put me in an episode. He gave me a name. He called me Duckstein. And, okay, he said, okay, you're going to be sitting in a Japanese restaurant. I'm Larry. Larry's talking, right? I'm going to walk in. You're going to recognize me from L.A., and you're going to ask me that since we're both on the same coast, why don't we go for lunch? Okay? That's all I knew. So I went up, and I greeted him, and I proposed that you want lunch. And Larry, you can tell from the way he was behaving towards Duckstein, wanted nothing to do with me. Okay? And I said, look, why don't we have lunch? He said, why should we have lunch? I said, because we never have a chance to do it in L.A. We're both in New York. Let's do it. He says, what's the difference? I said, because you should get to know me. He goes, I don't want to know you. I don't want to have lunch with you. I said, that's because we never have a chance to spend time together. I don't want to spend time together. So basically, I'm begging him to have lunch, using the fact that we're on the same side of the country as an excuse, okay? And he brushes me entirely, all right? So that's scene one. Scene two, because I'm not having lunch with Larry, all I knew is they told me is that you'll be eating a pastrami sandwich by yourself, and you're going to choke, okay? And there's nobody around to save you because you're not eating with Larry, okay? All right. So we go to Central Park in the middle of August at like 10 in the morning. It's 1,000 degrees out. I'm eating pastrami. I'm taking bites of pastrami, you know, and just take after take after take. I'm giving myself the Heimlich. They say, don't give yourself. I go, no, okay, give yourself the Heimlich. All right. And I've never eaten so much pastrami at 10 o'clock in August than outside in my life. When that was over with, the third scene was, okay, you're going to be in the hospital. Larry's going to come visit you. All right. Because he feels guilty because you started choking because he wasn't there to have lunch with you and give you the Heimlich. And I'm now in a hospital bed, and we end up having lunch, eating hospital food together. Okay? So that was the run that I had. But I only knew the bullet point. So everything else was ad-lib. And you do it over and over again, and they'll navigate you more of that, less of that. But, you know, for the, oh, maybe all told, I was, let's say, on the show 6 minutes of me. There must have been 40 minutes that we shot, you know. And I didn't see it until it was on the air, and I had forgotten most of what I said, you know. So it was fun. So Paul Dooley is absolutely right. It's you get people who are good on their feet. You look at Susie Essman. You look at, you know, now the late, unfortunately, Bob Einstein. You look at those people and what they're capable of doing. Ted Danson. They Larry tells them, okay, when we get on the set, say whatever you want, but hit these points because that's our plot.
Alan Zweibel, so much more I wanted to ask you about. We haven't talked about books, haven't talked about you trying to pick up a woman at the Anne Frank house. I hope we can get you back on and talk more because you've had such an interesting life and still producing tremendous works with two books out in the last year, right?
Well, I've got two books coming out this coming year. I had two books in the last year. This coming year, I have two books. One that I've written with Dave Barry, the great Dave Barry, and Adam Mansbach. And if you don't know his name, gee, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this word on your radio.
Yes, of course.
You can. Adam Mansbach wrote a children's book a couple of years ago.
I know that, like, yes.
Am I allowed to say the title of the book?
Can you bleep yourself on that one word?
Okay, go to sleep, okay? And so the three of us wrote a book that's coming out in September called A Field Guide to the Jewish People, who they are, where to find them, what to feed them, you know, what do they have against for. The subtitle is like a page long. And then next April, I have a cultural memoir, which is very much about my career, which is called Laugh Lines, 40 Years Trying to Make Funny People Funnier. And I take you through the Catskills and SNL and the Gary Shandling Show and Broadway when I helped my friend Billy Crystal write 700 Sundays, and a lot of my collaboration. So it's a Coach Delma, like a tour guide. So that comes out next April.
Well, excellent. Well, I hope we can get you back on when one of the books comes out.
I would love to.
It's been a real treat, Alan. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's Alan Zweibel here on Downtown.